Welcome to this Tuesday's Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. If you had a nice three-day weekend, we sure hope you enjoyed it. And coming up just a bit here on the show, before homesteads and prairie towns, the long journey to get here. Handwritten pioneer narratives from Icelandic families reveal the exhausting path immigrants travel to the northern plains, and Dr. Tom Ezern shares the stories in another of his great plainsfolk essays. Welcome to Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. North Dakota is a state defined by its rural communities, from family farms and tribal nations to energy-producing regions and small-town healthcare systems. And now North Dakota State University is launching a new research partnership with the RAND Corporation to focus on the challenges and opportunities facing rural, remote, and indigenous communities across North Dakota. Collaboration brings together NDSU's land-grant mission and deep community engagement with RAND's national reputation for nonpartisan, evidence-based policy research. The goal? Develop practical solutions in workforce development, healthcare access, agricultural innovation, and economic sustainability. All certainly worthy goals, Dr. Heidi Grunwald. She joins me here on Main Street. She's the Interim Vice President for Research and Creative Activity at NDSU. Dr. Grunwald, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you, Craig, and thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. Let's start broadly. What prompted this partnership between NDSU and RAND, and why now?
About a year ago, RAND did a pilot project with the University of West Virginia, and with their mission of helping rural communities build on strengths, address challenges to thrive, They went to the University of West Virginia and described a pilot project that, you know, was in the vein of, we are a group of scientists and policy researchers. We are very interested in the rural community challenges, and we'd like to do something together where your state legislature or your president's office or your policymakers could decide what are the important questions policymakers in West Virginia need to know to make smart policy, so that we can work on things like workforce development, you know, high quality education. And so they minted an MOU with the University of West Virginia, and the collaboration went so well that University of West Virginia said, yes, we find value in this. We're happy with the policy products that you created for us, and we'd like to re-up. And I think that was sort of their proof of traction. And then they decided they would expand to other land grant universities in rural communities, and in particular where they have a RAND scientist who's living in that community. And so they approached me here in Fargo at NDSU, because we are a land grant in a rural state, and RAND has a scientist here named Jessica Jensen, who was a faculty member at NDSU for more than 15 years. And she recently left NDSU to become a policy researcher at RAND. So we had the perfect combination. And so they came to me with the idea. I have a long history of working with RAND scientists in the area of substance abuse. I was very familiar with the organization, so it wasn't a very hard sell for me, because I know the quality of research that's produced inside of RAND and in collaboration with RAND. So I took the idea to President Cook when he was here, and you know, he too was familiar with RAND and was very excited about the opportunity. So that's how this came about.
What does RAND bring to the table that our listeners may not know about that really complements NDSU's land grant mission?
So RAND has a vast array of subject matter experts. So RAND's centers and divisions span everything from AI and technology to workforce development, education, health, healthcare, and substance abuse, critical infrastructure, energy and the environment, water security, food security, agriculture, and they have global programs as well. So they have programs that study China, that study Australia, Europe, and And then in addition to the subject matter experts, they also have clusters of methodological expertise that smaller institutions like NDSU may not have in-house.
I think Dr. Cook said prior to his leaving that the partnership would help translate research into, and I quote now, actionable strategies. Tell us what that might look like in practical terms for North Dakota communities.
Sure. You could, if you are someone who's listening and you're not familiar with RAND, that R-A-N-D, you can go to the website and look at the types of commentaries and briefs and studies that they produce. And one of their most recent studies is around governance structures and approaches to secure AI. And that's a term everyone's hearing all day, every day. What does it mean for the common person? What does it mean for us in our communities, farms, ranches, businesses? And states and the federal government are trying to figure out, you know, how do we regulate or do we regulate AI? You know, and there's some conversations about preemption and whether or not the federal government will preempt states from regulating. And so RAND has laid out a really nice way to think about what states might do and why they might do it in terms of a public-private mix, right? Do we rely on government to do it, or do we rely on the industry players that are producing AI in these models? Or do we rely on some sort of interplay between the two? So I think that's just one example. Another example might be, you know, funding formulas for big systems like K through 12 or higher ed that play out in our lives every day. How are we funding our K through 12 systems today? Does that make sense? Is it working? Is it modernized? And we could do this. We could do the same thinking about higher education here in North Dakota. You might think about workforce needs and, you know, how do we look at what the future workforce needs of North Dakota are, not today, but where are they going to be 10 years from now when every AI, you know, every graduate has experience with AI, and where are we as an institution working together with industry to make sure that we're preparing our graduates for their next step in life? So
do you see this then as somewhat maybe transformational for NDSU in that aligning then academic research to then support the very practical needs of employers in the sectors that you just mentioned, relative to workforce expansion, relative to support of indigenous communities, relative to support of rural healthcare? State just decided to spend $200 million, right, on rural healthcare now, and the RAND Corporation maybe comes in and adds to work that's already been done?
Well, I would say, I might rephrase that. I might say that we are going to spend $199 million that the federal government gave us. And North Dakota's job is to make sure that we spend it in ways that leverage the support of both the rural infrastructure, the rural care infrastructure, whether it's hospitals or clinics, and thinks about the ways in which we as institutions of higher ed and other institutions are providing that critical workforce. And I might just give you a basic example. A lot of the challenges that UND and NDSU have when we send, whether it's nurses, whether it's, you know, PAs, RAs out, RNs out into the western side of the state to do a residency, a practicum, there's no housing. There's a shortage of housing in the rural communities they're intended to serve for that period of time, whether it's 2 months, 4 months, 6 months. And so we've been thinking about ways to, you know, modernize, let's say, nursing homes that have been closed or other buildings that have been closed, where we might renovate facilities so that we can house the very rural workforce that needs to be there. And looking at the effects of the ways and return on investment for the ways that those dollars are spent is absolutely right up RAND's alley.
Enjoying my conversation with Dr. Heidi Grunwald from North Dakota State University, where she's the Interim Vice President for Research and Creative Activity. We're talking about NDSU's launching of a new research partnership with the RAND Corporation that wants to focus on challenges and opportunities facing rural, remote, and indigenous communities across the state. How do you see, Dr. Grunwald, this effort supporting indigenous communities across North Dakota?
So we are in a you know, we just launched the partnership. And so the next steps for us will be listening sessions and engaging. And so we will do a couple of listening sessions on campus with our own faculty to see what is from the ground up, what is of interest, where are our faculty engaging in the, with these communities, who's bringing topics to the table of these are the big questions we have right now. How do we solve X? And then we will do that out with communities because we want to be responsive to things that really are happening on the ground. And I think that's going to take a while. That might take 2 months to 3 months of gathering ideas and topics and prioritizing ideas and topics. They will work out of the gate with the National Science Foundation ND AgTech Engine, which is the large historic $160 million over 10-year award, looking at ways to use technology to benefit our farmers and ranchers, you know, to increase profitability, to reduce inputs. And, you know, at this point, what we are saying is food security is national security. Right? If we can't secure our food supply and make sure that our farmers and ranchers have a viable livelihood, then we're in trouble. So that's a place where RAND can engage immediately. And that's something that is, you know, the engine, the staff there has been out and about across the state talking to farmers, growers, producers, ranchers about what their current needs are. So that's a place where they'll engage immediately. And then we also are potentially interested in engaging with the state, whether it's the governor's office or potentially State Board of Higher Ed, to think about ways in which a collaboration between NDSU faculty and RAND scientists can benefit.
Is that the way you engage then either community colleges or other universities in the state of North Dakota through those particular engagements that you just spoke about?
We will do internal listening sessions first, and then we will think with RAND about engaging in particular communities, whether they are geographic places or whether or not they are, you know, let's say the predominantly undergraduate institutions or the State Board of Higher Ed or the governor's office. And I think, you know, I'm going to lean on RAND a little bit in terms of what they have the bandwidth for, right? They are, there's just to be clear, no resources flowing between RAND and NDSU and NDSU and RAND. It is a memorandum of a standard understanding that says together we can do more than we can do by ourselves.
What does meaningful engagement look like? You've talked about, you've used that word a couple times now. Are you hopeful the public too, other than just maybe the university, maybe just state government, maybe others can end up participating in this process? And if they do, what can meaningful engagement look like here in Fargo or across rural North Dakota?
That's a really interesting question. I don't think we got that far in terms of imagining ways in which the public would engage. And so I'll make a distinction here because you'll hear the term outreach and then you'll hear the term engage. And outreach has become sort of an outdated term because the signal means kind of one way. Right? One group is reaching out, whereas engage really is let's hear, let's listen, let's work together. And that means that the communities who have the needs or the concerns or a question about what should we do should be driving the engagement. And that's why here on campus, the listening sessions are simply that. They're brainstorming sessions. They're bringing forth ideas where faculty are working in areas across the state and across the region for challenges that, you know, the Upper Great Plains are facing, and where RAND might say, oh, we have a lot of expertise in this area, well, you know, let's do that, versus we haven't really thought about what would it look like if we did a series of town halls, public town halls. And, you know, I'm not sure if RAND would be interested in that, but I can certainly bring it up. I think they would find it interesting. What I can tell you is that personally, we are facing a lot of issues right now that affect civil society. And, you know, surely there'd probably be some interest in hearing what resources NDSU and or RAND together can bring to bear.
Dr. Grunewald, what is the timeline for this work? When do you expect deliverables to be available either to NDSU or the greater North Dakota community?
So we are thinking about a couple of different things. One of which is to create some commentaries, you know, and commentaries will be quicker. So that will, you know, that might be around a topic area in the rural health space or you know, AI and tech or workforce, where we immediately have a question out of the gate, and Rand could get to work immediately with potentially faculty from NDSU around creating a 3 to 5 page commentary about what are the exact questions that need to be answered. Where can we move a needle? Where are the levers, right? Like, how do we move the needle on something? What can we, you know, raise funding, decrease funding, increase a partnership, think about something a different way? So that's the first thing. We'll be creating some commentaries. That'll probably happen in the first, 4 to 5 months. The longer term plan, you know, and this again for us is a pilot project that's 12 months long, would be more of like a policy study. And that's really getting deep in an issue that is specific to North Dakota, right? That might be, how are we funding our K-12 system? Or what are the energy workforce needs today out in the area, and how do we think about filling them? Do we have to import labor, right? Like, North Dakota has been having this conversation for a long time. Can we think about it differently? And how are the ways in which people move and are incentivized to move to areas? How have they changed? Something like that might be a little longer, in where there's potentially a primary data collection, or there's a secondary data analysis, or there's an economic analysis. That might be a 12-month project. So I think people will see products right out of the gate pretty quickly, maybe 4 months in terms of commentaries. Deeper studies might take a little longer, you know, and after 12 months, we'll look back and we'll say, is this working? Do we still like each other?
Let's hope so.
Yeah.
At its core, Dr. Grunwald, as we kind of wind up our conversation here, how do you think the partnership reflects on NDSU's identity as a student-focused land-grant research university here in this state?
Well, this is why, you know, I think both President Cook and I were so, not eager, I would say we're very interested in this partnership, because as a land grant, it is our job to serve the state. You know, we educate the future workforce here. We engage with our ranchers and farmers, with our extension research extension sites. We're answering questions about, you know, seed varietals that can withstand harsh winters and short growing seasons and grow stronger and hardier and all of those things. So we are an applied research institution at its heart, but we still do have a large cadre of faculty advancing basic science. And so we have to think broadly, and we want to engage with the communities where we think we can improve lives.
Before I let you go, Dr. Grunwald, got to ask you before we started recording, I was surprised at how excited you are that North Dakota State University is joining the Mountain West Conference. And I think that from the inside here of NDSU may surprise some folks. What's so exciting about that relationship for you?
Well, I am a retired professional volleyball player, and so I spent 4 years in college athletics. My brother is here in town. He is on the NDSU volleyball staff. So we've been an NCAA athletic family for a long time. We're deeply embedded in both participating in supporting NDSU athletics, as well as, I even sometimes meet with recruits on campus. So I'm super excited about it, because when I go to the games, I want every seat to be filled. I love that Fargo Dome. It's such great energy. So I hope that this will re-energize fans in the state and both fill those seats, and that'll be great both for the players and for NDSU, but also just, you know, being FBS is just a different level of competition. So I think, you know, it's wonderful to win national championships, but it's really amazing opportunity for the athletes who come here to play at the next level.
Would you be advocating, with your history with volleyball, that Olympic sports and other things ultimately also move up?
I'm not going to comment, because that is way above my pay grade. I know that would be an expensive endeavor, and that's all I'll say about that. I think the travel would be pretty prohibitive.
That's Dr. Heidi Grunwald. She's the Interim Vice President for Research and Creative Activity at North Dakota State University. And our primary discussion was about a new research partnership with the RAND Corporation aimed at strengthening workforce development, healthcare access, agricultural innovation, and economic sustainability in rural, remote, and indigenous communities across North Dakota. And early findings from the collaboration are expected maybe even later this year and could help shape state, federal, and local policy in the future. Dr. Grunwald, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Craig.
Support for Brave Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Better Homes and Gardens Real Estate Alliance Group of Bismarck, helping families reach their dreams throughout the Bismarck-Mandan area. More information at BillDeanHomes.com.
Still ahead on this Tuesday's Main Street, immigrant journeys preserved in Icelandic pioneer mother narratives, indigent voices reshaping the story at Mesa Verde, and rising demand testing the future of the 988 Crisis Lifeline. That's all to come on Main Street right after this news. This is Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We often picture settlement on the Northern Plains beginning with a homestead claim and a patch of ground. But for many immigrant families, the real story started long before the first fence post, across oceans, rail lines, and unfamiliar landscapes. Historian Dr. Tom Easer reminds us that migration was less a single move than a test of endurance measured in miles, weather, and hope.
Transatlantic immigration to America in the 19th century was truly a daunting decision, a severe test of body, spirit, and resolve. I'm reading about it in the Pioneer Mother Narratives set down by the Gardar Homemakers Club, Women of Icelandic Descent, the files preserved by NDSU's Institute for Regional Studies. Some are typed, most are handwritten. They capture a defining cultural experience encoded in individual stories. The journey is the thing, the essential element in each narrative. Mrs. Jonathan Lindahl, née Ingeborg Sophia Benediktsdóttir, departed Iceland with her husband bound for Dakota Territory in 1887. I read, "They traveled first on horseback over Iceland to the coast, where they boarded the ship which took them to Quebec, Canada, via Glasgow, Scotland. From Quebec, they traveled by train to Winnipeg, Manitoba, and from Winnipeg, they went by train as far as St. Thomas, North Dakota, where they were met by Bjorn Blondell, driving a team of horses and wagon. On their way to Mountain, North Dakota, they stopped overnight in some abandoned shack. Next day, they reached Mountain. Horseback. Yeah, I'm picturing them bouncing cross-country on those little Icelandic horses. Surely not much baggage. Steamships, trains, horses, and wagons, sleeping in an abandoned shack. If there had been a printed itinerary at the outset, would they ever have started? Or consider the immigration journey of Helga Kristjansson Sumlidason, who by the time she told her story was living in Seattle. She came to Gardar, North Dakota, from Ísafjörður, Iceland, on the small ship Laura, which left September 5, 1884. It landed at Leith, Scotland, 2 weeks later, after a stormy voyage. Helga was traveling with her husband and three children by his former marriage. The party traveled by train to Glasgow, and after 3 days waiting, went by a ship of the Anchor Line to New York. The Atlantic crossing was very stormy, and the ship was so delayed that a search ship had been sent out to determine its whereabouts. The trip from New York to Buffalo was by train, from Buffalo by ship across Lakes Erie, Huron, and Superior to Duluth, from there by train to Pembina, North Dakota. From Pembina to Mountain, the journey was continued by horses and wagon. There, the new arrivals moved in to stay with a family living in a log house near Gardar, before establishing their own place in the town. Reading on. During the spring of 1885, they purchased an acre of land in Gardar, A small timber house was built on it, which became the family home for 4 years. 2 children were born there. Supplementing his small capital by cultivating the small plot of ground, raising chickens, milking 1 cow, the family lived tolerably well. That phrase, tolerably well, says a lot. They got by, and it was tolerable. Helga's husband was a watchmaker without much business in Gardar. I suspect Helga was subsisting the family by working their little acre. They scrimped and saved and finally were able to buy 40 acres over at the town of Milton, where they lived out their lives, having survived immigration and hardship, but never prospering impressively. And yet I read of their struggle through the writing of their granddaughter, who is composing an impressive literary narrative alongside the other members of her ladies' club, which was an extension homemakers group. As I always explain to my students, you can't understand immigration to the prairies according to individual ambitions. It was a matter of hope for the children.
Those families may have never thought of themselves as remarkable. They simply did what was necessary so the next generation might live a little easier. In their letters and memories, the distances shrink, but the courage doesn't. Dr. Tom Easern's Plains Folk reminds us that the prairie wasn't just settled, it was reached, one difficult leg at a time.
The Empire Theater Company in Grand Forks presents a new comedy for adults, The Nut Lab, by Kathy Cudell King, February 12th through the 21st. The play follows strangers in a nutrition study, each with personal motives and quirks, alongside the staff who oversee them. More information at EmpireArtCenter.com.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Mesa Verde National Park in southwestern Colorado is increasingly featuring the voices of indigenous descendants from the area. Colorado Public Radio's Elaine Tassi has more.
Take a drive through sprawling Mesa Verde National Park near Durango in southwest Colorado, and if you download and play the audio loop tour offered by the National Park Service, you'll hear the voice of a direct descendant narrating it, 71-year-old TJ Otzi.
At one time, the Pueblo people were nomadic. They would find a good place with an abundance of deer and elk, or rich harvests of berries and piñon, or pine nuts. They would stay for a while.
She's talking about Mesa Verde, an hour from Durango off any main road, back into a land of ancestral Pueblo Indians who inhabited it from the years of about 550 until 1300. Centuries later, hundreds of architectural structures remain, pit houses, towers, kivas, and cliff dwellings, some only accessible by a 30-foot ladder. 500,000 people from around the world visit this place every year. TJ's tour offers details only a descendant can.
My name is Thelma Jean Atzi, TJ for short. I am Laguna Pueblo, a direct descendant of the people who used to live here. This is still a living place. We still make pilgrimages back to Mesa Verde to visit the ancestors and gather strength and resilience from them.
Besides narrating the tour, TJ also works in the gift shop. She says efforts to put voices of descendants in places where guests can hear them makes her proud.
That people are listening to it, that I've been able to contribute to something like this that is touching all people from all over the world. And they're hearing me, they see me, they hear my voice. Is that her? They see my name tag. Hey, that's TJ. Kind of thing.
She created the new audio script around 2017.
It started out as a 3-4 hour interview with 2 former rangers here, and then little by little it kind of evolved into the Mesa Loop audio after revisions and editing. And
another example of how Mesa Verde is including voices of descendants is in the 17-minute film that plays every half hour in a small auditorium in the visitor center.
Homes were painted with images of the natural world. Some Pueblo people interpret these triangles as mountains. In places, you can see fingerprints pressed into mortar and handprints on walls. signs of those who built and lived in these homes.
We've all engaged with the space, and so a lot of our spirits remain.
Its director, Jennifer Boyd, who is not Native, says they started making the film around the pandemic with $100,000 after winning a contract to produce it. The film started playing in 2023. She says a lot of the crew has ties to Mesa Verde.
Yes, we had a producer slash advisor, our narrator, our composer. We had a working group of about seven people, and then we worked with the Parks tribal members.
She says descendant Native groups had final script approval. In the past, the narrative of Mesa Verde focused more on the white archaeologists who studied it than on the people who had built it and actually lived there. For example, National Geographic put together a short film in the 60s, calling them Klansmen, making reference to Christopher Columbus, and showing images of white archaeologists.
When their work is finished, the site will serve as an alternate attraction for the swelling tide of thousands who visit Mesa Verde National Park each year. By then, modern man should know more about the Anasazi than those citizens of the cliffs knew about themselves.
The museum refresh has been in the planning stages since 2019. It will also feature input from Native voices. Ranger Dalton Dorrell, a park spokesperson, says it hasn't been completely updated since the 1920s.
And so in this redesign, we want the multiple perspectives. Especially bringing in those indigenous communities are key.
Outdoor tours resume next spring, but the film can be seen all year long. At Mesa Verde, I'm Elaine Tassi, CPR News.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Nodak Insurance Company, serving North Dakota for over 75 years, providing insurance products from auto, home, farm, and business. Details at nodakins.com.
Mental health hotlines can be particularly valuable in rural areas where there might not be any therapists or social workers close by. That includes 988, the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. It launched less than 4 years ago and has already responded to nearly 20 million contacts. But support for 988 is stronger in some states than others. Harvest Public Media's Michael Marks has more.
The 988 system was designed to give people in crisis an easy-to-remember number that's available 24 hours a day. Every state has its own set of call centers with trained operators, and since the hotline started taking calls in 2022, demand has increased nationwide.
We have been seeing a month-over-month increase in utilization of 988, and so we are also working pretty hard to keep up.
That's Monica Kurz, Chief Administrative Officer for Health Source Integrated Solutions in Kansas, one of the state's 988 call centers. She says the service is a necessity for rural Kansans.
We know that in our rural and frontier counties in Kansas, folks might be traveling hours to get to their nearest mental health clinic. And this is a way to access services right away without that kind of distance barrier.
Responding quickly is essential. A caller frustrated with a long wait time might hang up. Plus, if they spend 2 minutes on hold, the call is rerouted from a local facility to a national backup center. A backup operator may not be able to connect someone with local resources, says Lauren Moyer, chair of Missouri's 988 Task Force.
If someone is really struggling with substance use and needs connected to a residential substance use bed in the moment, somebody from another state is not going to have access to that information.
When the 988 hotline launched, the federal government paid for it, but states were expected to pick up the tab eventually. That has not happened in Texas yet. Jennifer Battle is vice president of the Harris Center in Houston, which fields 988 calls. During a legislative hearing last year, she said the state's call centers get around 200,000 calls annually, and the state needs to step up and help fund the program.
As impressive as these numbers are that we're able to serve with the current federal funds, these funds only allow for us to be able to answer on average 84% of the 988 calls that originate in Texas.
The federal 988 bill recommended that states pay for the program through fees on telecommunication products. That's how 911 is largely funded. Only a dozen have done so, including Minnesota and Illinois. But in Missouri, they're doing things a little differently, dedicating money from the state's general fund each year. Lauren Moyer, the Missouri State Task Force chair, worries about sustainability.
You know, general revenue support, it's its own line item, and that's not guaranteed long term.
Oklahoma doesn't have a recurring fee to support 988 either. According to State Representative Kevin Norwood, a Republican from the Tulsa area, there's little appetite in the state legislature for a new tax.
Before I became a legislator, that idea was introduced and it gained no traction.
Norwood is now sponsoring a bill that would create a trust fund for 988, which would ensure the money is only used for the hotline.
When I jumped into it, I was like, okay, we need to make it where it's not just a short-term fix, that it would be long-term and sustainable.
Texas has followed a similar path. Lawmakers there have been unable to pass a telecommunications fee through the legislature. In 2025, Texas established a trust fund, but the balance is currently zero. Jonathan Pirtle studies 988 funding at the New York University School of Global Public Health.
Those trust funds are a strategy, but if there's not funds in the trust fund, it's not going to have that much of an impact. But it's something that some states are trying. It's a signal of effort, I suppose.
Pirtle is near the end of a five-year study. He's analyzing the funding of 988 systems in all 50 states. So far, he's found that those with long-term dedicated funding for staff are generally more efficient.
The big thing is people, right? The staffing, the people to work in these call centers is the main thing.
He may have a new data point in the near future. Missouri's legislature is set to consider a 988 funding fee later this year. I'm Michael Marks, Harvest Public Media.
Here's Chuck Lura with Natural North Dakota.
Do you ever wonder what the winter landscape looked like on the prairie long ago when there were no farmsteads, transmission lines, and such? And what few trees that were present were largely restricted to the floodplains of major rivers? There are some interesting written descriptions of that landscape. O.E. Rovog's Giants in the Earth is a classic novel about pioneer life on the prairies of Dakota Territory. Try to visualize his description of the plains during winter. I quote, "A gray waste, an empty silence, a boundless cold. Snow fell, snow flew, a universe of nothing but dead whiteness," unquote. Philippe Regis de Taubriand was a command of Fort Stevenson in Dakota Territory from 1867 to 1869. In his book, Military Life in Dakota, he describes the snow after a snowstorm, quote, "formed banks or waves everywhere, which at a distance, and especially when the sun rose a little above the horizon, bear a striking resemblance to the waves of a vast lake stirred by the breeze. The color is close to that of water reflecting a white sky, and if it were not for the stillness, the illusion would be striking," unquote. It worked on his psyche. I quote, "How tired I am of this interminable winter, of this everlasting snow, which for more than 3 months has hidden the color of the earth from us and blinds our eyes with its unchanging whiteness," unquote. But Theodore Roosevelt's description of winter in the Badlands in his book Ranch Life and a Hunting Trail is perhaps the most quoted description of winter on the North Dakota plains. Quote, "When the days have dwindled to their shortest and the nights seem never-ending, then all the great northern plains are changed into an abode of iron desolation," unquote. The landscape has changed much since Roosevelt's time, of course, but there are still places that can give you a sense of that time and place. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
If you're listening to the 3 p.m. broadcast of Main Street, catch up on the news and stories from around the world, the nation, and here at home on All Things Considered. That's up next on Prairie Public. And if you're listening to us during the evening broadcast, keep it here for Kelly Corrigan Wonders. That follows Main Street on Prairie Public.
The 2026 AARP Community Challenge Grant Program is now accepting applications through March 4th. Eligible nonprofits and government entities can apply for quick action grants that help communities become great places for people of all ages. Past project grants have addressed public places, transportation, housing, digital connections, disaster resilience, and more. Learn more at aarp.org/community challenge.
The Endangered Endangerment Finding. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Last week, the Trump administration took steps to rescind the EPA's endangerment finding made during the Obama administration that greenhouse gases are dangerous to public health and welfare.
At the announcement, EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin said they are driving a dagger into the heart of the climate change religion.
The action removes the legal basis for regulations on pollution coming from tailpipes and power plant smokestacks, among others.
The endangerment finding was made on the basis of a huge body of scientific evidence that carbon dioxide, methane, and four other gases are dangerous to human health and welfare.
It was made after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2007 that greenhouse gases are pollutants under the Clean Air Act, which the EPA is required to regulate if they are found to be harmful. After that case, the agency made the endangerment finding.
Now, Trump's EPA is effectively asking the current Supreme Court to overturn that decision, and the makeup of the justices could be in the administration's favor.
Before the High Court decides to review the EPA's rescission of the finding, there will be much litigation, which could last through the Trump administration's term.
The seven states of the Colorado River Basin did not reach an agreement by the Valentine's Day deadline imposed by the federal government on how to manage the river as climate change and long-term drought diminish snowfall and water.
As the date passed, there were separate statements issued by the governors of the Upper Basin and Lower Basin states.
Lower Basin governors from California, Nevada, and Arizona said that the management of the river must be based on a shared contribution and innovation with all users stretching to conserve. They maintain that they've already offered reductions in their share, which are firm and fair.
Representing Colorado in the process, Becky Mitchell said in a release that the Upper Basin is being asked to solve a problem they did not create with water they don't have, adding that their approach is in line with hydrologic reality and they are ready to move forward.
If the seven states can't agree, the Federal Bureau of Reclamation could mandate its own proposal later this year, which would probably lead to years of litigation.
Gene Shawcroft of Utah said at a press conference that the Upper Basin states are working with the Bureau on a plan to release water this summer from Flaming Gorge and other reservoirs to prop up Lake Powell, the second largest reservoir in the country.
That development comes as forecasters expect the small snowfall this winter will cause big problems this summer.
Speaking of snowfall, weather patterns in the Colorado River Basin and around the globe could be affected by a shift from the current La Nina conditions to El Nino later this year.
La Nina and El Nino are climate patterns driven by ocean surface temperatures in the Pacific. During a La Nina year in the U.S., winter temperatures are warmer than normal in the south and cooler than average in the north.
A shift to El Nino conditions pushes the jet stream south, leading to the northern U.S. being drier and warmer than usual. In the southeast, it could be wetter with an increased risk of flooding.
NOAA's Climate Prediction Center says there's nearly a 60% probability of El Nino conditions by autumn. Depending on its strength, it could drive severe storms, extreme rainfall, and drought in many areas of the globe.
According to climate scientist Dr. James Hansen, even a moderately strong El Nino may yield record global temperatures this year and into 2027.
And finally, Valentine's Day just passed, and for singles, you might have done your best to woo a potential partner with an attractive outfit or a winning smile. But if you were a frog, finding love is all about the croak.
That's the sound of a frog telling females that the water's just right for mating.
According to a new study by the University of California, Davis, water temperature affects the sound and quality of male frogs' mating calls. When it's colder in the early weeks of spring, their songs are kind of sluggish and a bit of a put-off.
But as the weather warms and the croaks pick up their pace, female frogs can't resist an energetic crooner. They know that the song indicates that the water temperature is perfect to lay eggs that will survive.
To reach their conclusions, the researchers recorded Sierran chorus frogs at two sites in Northern California and compared how their vocalizations changed as water temperatures rose.
They observed that male frogs arrive earlier to ponds than the females so they can warm up their voices and be ready to belt out their tunes.
However, the team says climate change could affect this performance as temperatures rise and seasons shift.
About 41% of amphibian species are threatened with extinction, making them the most endangered vertebrate class. Understanding when they breed, as global warming continues, will be critical to their conservation.
That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 17th. North Dakota winters have been described as consistently very cold, with January and February typically the coldest months. This comes as no surprise to North Dakotans, who often take a certain pride in thriving in such a severe environment. Daytime temperatures tend to hover between the teens and the mid-20s, while nighttime temperatures dip into the minus 10 to minus 20 degree range, and sometimes fall to minus 40. The year 1936 began with an extreme cold and then got worse. It was defined by an extraordinary cold spell, even by North Dakota standards. On this date, in 1936, partial North Dakota reported a state and national record low of minus 60 degrees. The unusually cold weather stretched from the Rocky Mountains to the Great Lakes, with nine states recording record lows. North Dakota sat squarely in the middle of it. While partial claimed the record, no one in the state escaped the misery. Temperatures of minus 42, minus 46, and minus 43 were common. Nothing was easy in the extreme cold. The simplest daily chores became major productions. Going shopping meant venturing out into dangerous weather. Those who relied on automobiles were often out of luck, as cars simply wouldn't start. With no way of knowing how long the cold would last, families cut back on meals to stretch their supplies. Even when people reached a store, shelves were often nearly empty. Staying warm? Well, that was another challenge. Homes were poorly insulated, and families gathered in a single room, closing off the rest of the house to conserve heat. People layered their clothing, huddled together, and pulled out every comforter and quilt they owned. The severe cold finally began to ease as February ended and March arrived. Fargo reached the relatively balmy temperature of 32 degrees on March 1st. The warming, however, brought new problems. Avalanches struck the Pacific Northwest, and melting snow and thawing ground caused widespread flooding along rivers and affected areas. North Dakotans sighed with relief, unaware that Mother Nature was not finished yet. On July 6th, 1936, the state recorded a high temperature of 121 degrees. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Ahead tomorrow on Main Street, Energy Innovation meets Culinary Celebration. We'll explore how next-generation geothermal could turn the heat beneath our feet into reliable, around-the-clock power. And then we'll head to Bismarck, where an award-winning burger blends North Dakota appetite with bold flavor. We look forward to seeing you again tomorrow, right here on Main Street.